Good morning, everyone. I used to positively hate Friday morning assemblies. They were beyond purgatory. Some stranger would visit the school and drone on. So there was a cost-benefit analysis. The benefit was missing class. The cost was often slipping into a deep and irreversible coma from which there was no guarantee you would ever awake. So I do not plan to drone on, especially in light of our limited time. Other than to share with you a thought I had just last week. It was New Year's Eve, and while the world was partying and imbibing enormous quantities of alcohol, I was thinking about a student that I had met only for 15 minutes 17 years ago and whom I never met again. Because I met him 3 days before the new year, and I think about him every secular new year. 17 years ago, when I was a rabbi at Oxford University, it was late in the afternoon, and I received a phone call from a student who said to me, "I have to see you immediately, it's an emergency." I told him, "I'll see you tomorrow." He said, "It's an emergency." I said, "Okay, I have a few minutes, come now." So my office was in the Oxford City Center. He was at one of Oxford's 35 colleges, it's called Magdalen, very prestigious college. He runs out of breath, comes into my office, and he says to me, "I just discovered something shocking about my identity." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, it turns out that the doctor of divinity in my college," which is Oxford's fancy name for a chaplain, "told me," Christian chaplain, "that because my mother is Jewish, I too am Jewish. I wasn't raised a Jew, my father's not Jewish. I don't think my mother even, she barely knows she's Jewish. And I'm shocked by this discovery." I said, "This is what you kept me for? This is the emergency? Take 2 aspirin, call me in the morning. What's the emergency?" So he said to me, "You have no right to claim me. I don't want to be Jewish." I said to him, "I had nothing to do with this. Ask your mother. Why are you holding me accountable? And I want to go home to my family's waiting. We're supposed to have dinner." He said, no, "I'm not letting you leave. Because I've researched this, and I've discovered," is that me? Indeed it is. This is him calling me 17 years later. "Stop talking about me." Thank you. Okay, we will move right on. He said to me, "I found out there is something you can do. You can excommunicate me." He said, "Excommunication?" He said, "Yes, I researched it, and it turns out that you can excommunicate me from the Jewish people." I said to him, "Excommunications are done in the most extreme circumstances." But he's still pushing me. I said, "You know what? I can't take this anymore." I said, "Look, I charge $100 for bar mitzvahs, $200 for circumcisions, $300 for weddings and $400 for excommunications. He said, why so steep? I said, because it costs more to get out than it does to get in. He said to me, do you have a student discount? I told him no, maybe I could throw in one of the bar mitzvahs of his sons, give him an IOU or something, but I then typed out the most ridiculous certificate of my life. I wrote, I, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, hereby excommunicate you and all your progeny from the Jewish people, now and forevermore, so help you God. And I handed him this worthless piece of paper just to get rid of the student that was driving me crazy. And as he's walking out, I said to him, not so fast. Because I have a question. And he turned around and he said, I know your question. I said, of course you know the question. It's the obvious question. What was the question?
Why?
Why? Why? You drove me crazy to type out a worthless piece of paper? This is a true story. A student insisting I excommunicate. What was wrong? What was the shocking discovery that you're Jewish? Why was that such a tragedy? And this is what he said to me. He said, I have read about how the Romans ruled and the Greeks philosophized and the British sailed and the Americans expanded and the Jews died and the Jews died and the Jews died. You're asking me why I don't want to be part of a nation whose only legacy is one of tragedy? Whose only legacy is one of rejection? Why am I shocked to become part of the most hated nation on earth that has contributed nothing? So I quickly engaged him into a debate. I said, what are you talking about? We contributed nothing. That's an insult. We gave the world God. What was his response? Really? What's God's name today? Jesus Christ. You didn't give the world God. Everybody's a Christian today. Oh, I said to him, but we gave the world the Ten Commandments. Morality. He said, no, you don't. No, you didn't. Today, that's called secular humanism. Being a good person. No one ascribes it back to the Jewish people. I said to him, we gave the world the idea of human dignity and the infinite worth of every individual from the book of Genesis. That God creates man in his image. And his response to me was, that's called democracy. One man, one vote, everybody being equal. Why do you need any contribution from the Jews? And that student walked up. And I never met him again. Interestingly, about 10 years later, I met his mother, who's an editor living in London. She told me the story. She said, my son shared the story with me. But I never saw him again. And that challenge that he put to me, that the Jews are now obsolete, that we stand for nothing except our self-preservation, has haunted me for 17 years. And it led to an entire book, which I'll get to in a moment. But do you understand what he was saying? You know, people all ask, why is the world anti-Semitic? Why hatred of the Jews? On university campuses, there's something called the ghost theory. Social anthropologists believe the reason the Jews are so hated is because nobody likes a ghost. If you had a ghost living in your house, you probably wouldn't like it very much. It haunts you. This nation gave the world all these great gifts, and we, like everyone else, the Greeks, the Romans, we should have died out a long time ago. But we have continued to persevere. And now we're claiming land in the Middle East, which other people are saying doesn't belong to us. We have Jewish day schools teaching what? What is our legacy? What is our contribution to the wider world? If we were to disappear tomorrow through assimilation, would the world be any worse? Anyone? I challenge you for a minute to tell me one thing that the world would be deprived of if the Jews were no more. Anyone? Anything. It's a serious question. If you took away Christianity from the world, You would take away God from a billion people. A billion people. If you took away Islam from the world, Islam has had a violent turn. But again, you would take away God, ethics, spirituality from a billion people. Buddhism the same. If you took away Judaism from the world, you'd affect 0.003% of the world population. If you took away Judaism from the world, would the universities in America close? Would no one study anymore? Where are the people in the book? Really? Asian Americans don't believe in study? Harvard doesn't believe in study? If we disappeared, what would be missing? This is what this student was asking me, and it's a question that has haunted me. When you wear a yarmulke on the street, when you insist on Jews marrying Jews, what's the purpose? Self-preservation? To sustain an ethnicity alone? Can anyone tell me one thing that the world would be missing? What? Bagels. Okay. We'd be missing bagels. How about the hole in the bagels? It's a very serious question. Anyone? Go ahead. What would we be missing?
A common enemy.
A common enemy.
Yeah.
Who's the common enemy?
Us.
If the Jews were gone, we would be missing us?
No.
That's true, but that's kind of logical. But wait, if the Jews were gone, you're saying we would be missing fighting with each other?
Oh,
the world would lose a common enemy. Oh, they'll choose another. For example, the Arabs were all slaughtering each other before the state of Israel was created. Shia and Sunni. And then they created Israel, so okay, now they attack Israel. They'd find a different scapegoat. They'd make blacks the scapegoat. There'd been other scapegoats besides the Jews, but I do appreciate your response. Anyone else?
Money.
Would the world be impoverished in the slightest? Money?
Money?
The world would be missing money. It's okay, Bernie Madoff took it all. There's nothing left. You know, isn't that an incredible thing? If America were to disappear from the world, democracy would be weakened. If Saudi Arabia were to disappear from the world with its land, oil would skyrocket. They have 24% of the world's proven reserves. What do the Jews stand for? You know, it's an interesting thing. Nations that can't answer that question always decline. I'll give you an example. I lived in England for 11 years. England once ruled 24% of the Earth's landmass. England today is a country, if you're reading about it, the economy is collapsing, but there's no national identity. There was even a study that showed that, get this, 49% of the British, if they had the money, they would leave the country and go somewhere else. Because the British brought parliamentary democracy to the whole world. They did a lot of good, they did a lot of bad too. But now that other countries, now democracy, 60% of the world's population, 60% of all United Nations members are democracies, who needs Britain anymore? When you don't have a national identity, you go into decline. Final time, before I give you a single thought on this subject. If the Jews were to disappear, what would the world be lacking? Anything? Can you guys imagine that you've been, like me, in Jewish education how many years now? 8 years, 9 years? Longer? 10 years? And not one person can tell me if the Jews were no more, what the world would be missing today? Not one? You've never thought about this question? Why it's important to be Jewish? What, to keep kosher? To put on tefillin? To put a yarmulke on your head? You mean you stand for nothing except rituals? And then you wonder why the stuff bores me to bits? Because an empty ritual that has no larger purpose is going to bore you to bits. What would the world lack? A couple of Nobel Prizes? I'm going to give you just one example. If you guys want to have a passionate Judaism, then you're going to have to identify a uniquely Jewish spirituality, which is good for the world. I'm just going to give you one example today, where we are radically different to all other nations of the world. Do you know that we Jews are the only ones who have a tradition of arguing with God, of wrestling with God, of questioning God? If you took the Jews out of the world, mankind would no longer have an authentic relationship with God. When there is a Holocaust, when there's some terrible tragedy, Christianity says to you, you have to have a leap of faith. God is always right and humankind is always sinful. And that's why it happened. The word Islam means quite literally what? What does it mean? Tell me what the word means. It means to submit. Islam is an act of submission. Same thing. God is always right. That's why a Muslim performs ablutions 5 times a day. Going all the way down like we do on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The essence of the religion is not to question. The essence of the religion is to obey. The same thing is true of Mormonism. What does Yisrael mean? What does the word mean? How does it translate? Yisrael means he who wrestles with God. He who argues with God. He who spars with God. You mean there's a unique form of spirituality where when something goes wrong or you experience life's disappointments, you have a right to question God? You have a right to actually be in such an authentic relationship that if you're angry, you can express your anger, you can express frustration, you can express disappointment? You mean that we human beings are not just cosmic chaff? We're not just an insignificant collection of molecules and protons and neurons, but there's actually a cosmic will inside us that's allowed to challenge God. There was a man. There's an author who wrote a story. Until today, it's based on a true story in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's called The Last Will and Testament of Yossel Rakovi. This is like the last day of the Warsaw Ghetto. Almost everyone's being slaughtered. The Germans have now brought in heavy artillery. They're bombarding the ghetto. There are shells exploding all over. He's in his last hours of life. He's a Baba Rechasa, and he pulls out a pen and paper and he starts to write. And he puts the will into a bottle. And this is what he wrote. He said, Lord, Master of the world, I have served you uniquely and lovingly throughout my life. I have never missed a minyan. I raised 11 children. 7 of them were carted off to the death camps. 4 remain with me. 2 have died of typhoid. My last child who was alive was a scout here in the ghetto, and he fell into our defensive area with a bullet between the eyes yesterday, taken out by a German sniper. I have lost everything that I had. And the only thing left to me is the right to finally deny you, to prove that you don't exist. That everything that I have lived for, I've lived for, is a lie. That if you could watch a spectacle like this of killers and monsters slaughtering children and still remain silent, that's because you simply don't exist. And then he suddenly said, but it's not true that everything has been taken away from me. Because I still have one thing. I still have my faith in you, and I am greater than you because I will not be defeated by you. I have lived as a Jew and I will die as a Jew. And there is nothing you can do to me that will ever break me. I did not come into this world for events to determine whether or not I would live with faith or die with faith. I rather have internalized it and it's with me. And you can never take it from me. And you've hit me with your best shots, but I will never be humbled and I will never be broken. And then his last words were, Hero Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. That a man can stand in the pit of hell and raise his hand in defiance to God and say, I am a person too, and this is a real relationship. I don't have to always submit. I don't have to always bend. That I can stand up straight as a Jew in every circumstance is one of the greatest contributions the Jews have ever given to the world. I sit with Christians who have lost their babies. They've died of leukemia. And their priests are telling them it's for the best. God has a plan. And what they're really being told is that you have to have a fraudulent relationship with God. You've got to take it on the chin and believe somehow that a 7-year-old baby dying is a blessing rather than a curse. And as if these parents haven't suffered enough, the priest will come and inflict upon them the final insult, that you actually deserve this, that somehow you and your husband must have been sinful, your grandfather, because God is always just. And human beings, well, either you've done something very wrong, or our minds are so puny that we can't understand God's larger plan. The priest would inflict upon them the final insult, that not only have you suffered, but somehow you've deserved it, or it's not really suffering. There's a hidden blessing that we don't see. But the Jewish perspective, and this is why we are such a vital nation to the world, is no. We can make this world a better place. Children don't have to die of cancer. There was nothing good to that. If you took the Jews out of the world, you know what you would get? You would get a world that ceased to dream. You would get a world that accepted that some kids are always going to die of starvation. That some diseases are never going to be cured. That some boys and girls are never going to be educated. That if when you conquer AIDS, some new plague will somehow affect us. And the only nation that says we have a right to challenge history and fate and create a new destiny is the nation that said 2,500 years ago that the time will come amidst all of the slaughter and all of the terrorism and all of the bombs and all of the IEDs and all of the dead soldiers coming home in coffins, the time will come when the wolf will lie with the lamb, when men will beat swords into plowshares. This vision of peace is a uniquely Jewish vision. This idea of making the world better, that we say three times a day in a lane. This vision of a more perfect world is so uniquely Jewish. That's why 24% of the world's Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. Because no matter how secular they were still inspired by a Jewish vision of conquering the world's ills. It's no coincidence that every utopia is invented by a Jew. That Karl Marx dreamed a dream that the proletariat would not be oppressed by the bourgeoisie. It was a wrong dream. It was corrupted and it became cruel and evil. Look at what China just did to the wife of a Nobel Peace Prize winner, locked her up the day he won. A brutal nation. And unfortunately, they get richer and richer because we Americans can't stop our spending, so we keep on borrowing from the Chinese. But the Jewish people are those who say that what is doesn't have to be. You know, I look around. When I was a teenager, I don't remember happy teen years. I thought the world was kind of a stupid place. It was about popularity, conformity, fitting in, sucking up to teachers. I didn't feel I was even learning anything. I didn't feel that my curiosity was being sparked, that I was being given a thirst for real knowledge. I was being given a thirst for subjects the school had chosen to give to me. I didn't feel I was developing. I didn't even feel I had an authentic Jewish spirituality. I didn't even know what it was about. I did not at that time understand that there was something so unique in Judaism that if I didn't practice it or keep it, the world at large would be impoverished. I sat with John Gostin. Let's get into popular culture for a moment. One of the most hated men in America, John and Kate Placeta. He becomes the biggest TV star with his wife. They transform reality television. Her father was a pastor. He's a nice Christian boy from Pennsylvania. They have sextuplets. They become world famous. He gets unhinged, absolutely unhinged, through fame. He is seen with young women all around the world, pictures are taken. And I meet him through a friend. And I looked at him and I said to him, you know, all fame is a spotlight. God gives you this giant searchlight, and you can do with it whatever you please. You can shine it on someone else, on a cause, or you can just put it entirely on yourself. But when you put it too much on yourself, that spotlight, it's like being under the sun. your skin begins to wilt. You get burned. Your morality has been burnt to a crisp. It's gone. But I want to tell you that there's a Jewish idea called Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, everything we do is wiped away in and of itself. Human beings discover a new innocence. He said to me, how do I discover that innocence? My religion is often about guilt and original sin. You can't wipe away sin. It's always about ascribing faith in Christ. I said, well, in my religion, the essence is action. New deeds. It takes one. He said, what is that one deed? I said, to go before the public. You humiliated your wife in public. You have to apologize to your wife in public. We went to a New York synagogue. Press came, but it was like another event that my organization does in New York. And he and I had an entire conversation about repentance, forgiveness, and at the end of it, I said, John, it's time. He looks, stands up, looks at the audience, and he says, a husband has a responsibility to be faithful to his wife. My wife and I are now divorced, but I humiliated her with my actions. And I want to, and as he's about to say, I want her to forgive me. He breaks down. He's crying. He can't speak. I said, John, it's time. And then he turns to me and says to me, I can't ask for her forgiveness. I said, why? He said, because I can't forgive myself. So in front of everyone, I told him, you can't forgive the man that did this, but you are not that man. Your new actions have created a new person, and you are not that man. The Rambam. When someone does teshuva, you can't even remind him of his previous deeds. We're not a religion that says you're born fated to always be sinful. We defy history to create a new beginning. It's a phenomenal idea. That's why the Jews are the greatest entrepreneurs and businessmen. We believe that we can actually, the Greeks believed in fate before you were born. Your life was scripted. Why do you think people read stupid horoscopes still today? You're a Pisces and you're a, it's ridiculous. Yesterday, I'm on Court TV in a national broadcast talking about the Conrad Murray trial, Michael Jackson's death. For 2 years of my life, I tried very hard to save Michael Jackson's life. Conrad Murray, and Michael was a man in a lot of pain, and there was his life was going to go in one of two ways. He was either going to address the source of that pain, get to its root cause, change his actions, and find meaning and purpose, or he was going to dull his feeling of existential pain, that his existence had taken a wrong turn, and he was going to have a truckload of prescription drugs. You have a doctor who's in a preliminary hearing right now, telling the world that it's not his fault that he became a pusher, giving a broken celebrity all of these drugs. And he wants to get off. And all I can think about is, 9 years ago, when I used to study Judaism with Michael Jackson, I used to say to him, one of the reasons that you're in so much pain is that you see your career in decline. It's called historical inevitability. Things peak and then they wane. Like nations. Most people are asking today, is America decline? The British declined. The Romans disappeared. The Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incans, they disappeared. America also, it had its time in the sun. Now we have financial problems that we can't even cure. But I said to Michael, every year, if you look at the Jewish New Year compared to the secular New Year, in the secular New Year, you dull pain. Whether it's fear of the new year, whether it's a desire not to really confront the challenge of renewal, what do people do on New Year's? They drink themselves to oblivion. In the Jewish religion, the new year is a time of contemplation. We understand that every person risks obsolescence unless they renew themselves. So we go before God, we recount our mistakes, and we commit to beautiful new action. And you can do the same thing. You can change. He said, how? I said, well, first of all, you're around people who aren't serious. You're the most famous celebrity in the world. You have to do serious things. So we went to Oxford University, and he gave a lecture to 2,000 students about a children's bill of rights. And he got a standing ovation from Oxford students. Then we went to Carnegie Hall. And we did an entire evening about parents learning to prioritize their children. And he got a standing ovation. But all of his managers came to him and said to him, "What you're doing is diminishing your brand. You're diminishing your fame. You've become ubiquitous. You're a guy who's supposed to fill stadiums of 100,000 people. They're supposed to scream your name. You're not supposed to give some serious talk at a university. They don't pay you millions of dollars for that." In fact, he wasn't being paid anything for it. So Michael said to me, "What do I do? They're telling me this is going to ruin my brand." I said, "What do? You do what God created you to do. Did God create you to be an idol? Did he create you to be another God? Is that what it's about? Popularity? Was it about being the prettiest girl in the class who was the thinnest? Was it about being the best athlete? Was God missing that from his world when he created you? Did he need someone to take the spotlight off goodness and put it on you? Were you there to suck up all the world's attention? Did any of us benefit from it? Or were you there to take that light and shine it on things that were larger than you?" You know, the tragedy was that he was given a fork in the road and he chose to go with his managers. It was the end of our relationship. I said a year later, I told his family, "Michael will be dead within 5 years." I then said it on CNN so that all of his publicists would hear. I said, "These people are going to be responsible. He will be dead in 5 years." That was April 22nd, 2004, on CNN America's Morning. He died 5 years and 3 months later, in June of 2009. Am I a prophet? Of course not. When a life loses purpose, when a life has no more meaning, it withers, it shrivels, it ends. The essence of the Jewish religion is that we were given a purpose to make us feel alive. And you guys at an Orthodox Jewish state school, you now have a choice. And you have a choice every single day. Are you going to live not by Jewish ritual, not by just putting on tefillin alone? Is this going to be something empty, something leather you tie on your arm, but you don't even think about why you're doing it, so it's such an empty experience, it's not transformative? I'm rushing to 2 years ago. I was in Utah, I had to fly to Kennedy Airport, take a taxi to LaGuardia, to fly to Washington in time for the Obama inaugural. I'm meeting this student, I meet this guy who says to me, "Oh, I'm also doing the same thing. I'm going to the inaugural, can I share a taxi with you?" So of course, we share a taxi, we rush, I don't think we're going to make it. We get to LaGuardia, Delta shuttle, we have like 20 minutes before the plane. I take out my tefillin, I start putting them on, it's 7 a.m. Says to me, "No, I'm Jewish. I study at Penn. I'm doing pre-med. I did that at my bar mitzvah. Found it ridiculous." Well, what is that? I said, "Well, if I tell you and if it makes sense to you, will you put them on with me?" He said, "If it makes sense." Anyone here? Raise your hand. Why do you put on tefillin? You've got 60 seconds to tell a Penn pre-med student who thinks Judaism is a stupid joke, it does nothing for him. He wants to be a doctor. That makes sense. He's going to cure people of illness. But tying yourself up in some ancient thing of a... Give me one, you got 30 seconds. Anyone?
Tradition.
What?
Tradition.
Tradition. That's not his tradition. He wasn't raised with it. Next. His tradition was not to put on tefillin. I was asking him to break his tradition. Good.
Represents your brain and heart.
What?
Represents your brain and heart.
Good. What does that mean?
Decision.
Very good. I had 60 seconds and I gave him your answer. I had 60 seconds. I said to him, "You know, I counsel lives that are out of control. I counsel marriages that are disintegrating. I counsel teenagers who are depressed. And you know what I discovered? The essence of a life that goes off the rails is simple. Your mind is your guidance system. Your heart is your engine. The mind discerns right and wrong and tells you what you should pursue. The heart is the motivation. It's what gets you to do it. If the two don't talk to each other, you're screwed. You're finished. If the mind is aloof and detached, and it doesn't send any signal to the heart, you become cold, you can't have relationships. If the heart is just passionate with no guidance system, you make all kinds of mistakes. Tefillin is a daily meditation of the need to synchronize the two. It's that simple. You put them on every minute, you think about that. Moach shalit al alev. The heart is really more important, Maimonides says, the Rambam says in the Marner book. But without the mind to guide it, you end up in the wrong places. I want to conclude with a very short story. I want to sum up what I'm saying. I started with a simple question. Why should you keep any of this aside from tradition? Your father raised you in this? So if you were raised to be totem worshippers, we'd do that too. I started with a simple question. Why are we doing all this? Because I don't want to be a Jew by accident. I don't want to be a Jew because my mother was Jewish. That's not what I want. I sometimes envy converts to Judaism who actually chose it out of passion, or a Baal Tshuva who chose to keep it. I was raised in a modern Orthodox family. And sometimes modern Orthodoxy means compromises that lead to a passionless Judaism. That's not for me. If I do something, I want to do it with my heart and my soul. And what I'm telling you is that if you understand what you're doing and you deepen your spirituality, you will begin to discern the uniquely Jewish contribution that we can make to the world without which the world is impoverished. I'm going to give you, I have two phones, forgive me, I'm sorry, I should have turned this one off as well. I want to end with a little story. For those of you who may have watched, and by the way, when I give examples from the popular culture, it's to demonstrate to you the power of Jewish ideas to affect people who are even not Jewish, and who command large followings, but who are looking for guidance in their own lives, let alone in ours. I want to conclude with this little story. Those of you who may have watched the show that I hosted on TLC called Shalom Aleichem, we had a girl from New Jersey who was 17, and her life was threatened with anorexia. Anorexia affects Jewish girls disproportionately. So 6% of all girls in the United States have an eating disorder, 6%. And of that 6%, something like 20% are Jewish, even though we're only 2% of the population. So we're represented 10 times our number. For those who have it, God forbid, it is more lethal than cancer, and it has no cure. It can only be treated. So the producers of the show wanted to do a show on anorexia. I didn't even know if we should do it because it's not my area of expertise. And you got to be very careful with people who have eating disorders. If you think you can handle it, even the experts can't handle it, let alone a novice like me. So I sit with a 17-year-old girl. She's just been released from hospital. My daughter Mushki is here today. We got to know the girl and her family very well. I brought my daughters to actually talk to her because I felt helpless doing this show. I brought all three of my daughters, I have three teenage daughters, to talk to the girl. But I'm sitting there one-on-one, we're filming this conversation, and I say to her, "How much do you weigh?" She didn't want to say. Her mother gave her permission, 87 pounds. I said, we have footage of you going to your fridge at 5 a.m., because we have cameras in the kitchen, and you picked up this thing of cheese, and you were about to put it to your lips, and then you put it down. What happened? She said, "I heard her voice." I said, what was the voice you heard? "Well," she said, "it's a voice I hear regularly. I call the voice Ed." I said, "Ed, who's Ed?" She said, "Ed is a voice in my head." I said, but who is he?" She said, "Well, I named him Ed for ED, eating disorder. And he talks to me whenever I pick up food." I said, "What does he say?" So she said, "Oh, he tells me that I'm beautiful and I can be more beautiful. That there are girls in my class who are thinner and they get more attention. And if I just put this down, I'll be even more popular." So I said to her, "This voice that you hear, Ed, is he a friend?" She said, "I think he's a friend. I know that he can overdo it, but I think he's a friend because he wants me to be beautiful and special." We end the session, I go into this little trailer we have where the producers are, and I say to them, "This is like the craziest conversation I've ever had. She hears a voice in her head that's trying to kill her, and it's a friend. I don't know how to handle this. I have no clue, I'm lost." We all sit and talk for an hour, and we decide, I'm gonna come in to continue the conversation, but this time with a stocking over my head, looking very sinister. I walk in, instead of laughing, she immediately goes, she says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm Ed." I said, no, really, Shmuley, stop. What are you doing?" I said, "I'm Ed." And I spoke to her in this monotone. I started telling her, "You're right. should not eat. If you eat, you're going to get fat. If you get fat, you're going to be ugly. If you're ugly, no one's going to like you. And she tells me to stop, and then she starts to cry. And she pulls the thing off my head. She said, why are you doing this? I said, so that you could see a picture whenever you hear Eddie of a sinister, destructive, malignant force. Do you know what Judaism is? It's a voice that speaks inside your head. It's a voice that tells you every time you're going to gossip about someone that you were born for higher things. There will be other voices. There'll be the voice of popularity. There'll be the voice of Wall Street. There'll be the voice of Hollywood. You will hear many voices inside your head. But the kol d'mama daka, that still small voice, that's what Judaism is. When someone asks me to help, will I help? If I walk into my house and there's stuff strewn all over the floor, whether I leave my mother to pick it up, what will that voice say to me? Judaism is a collection of incredible values that you can live by if you just attune yourself to that voice. And my friends, as I conclude, I want to tell you, in my life, the greatest joy I've had is when I've made a Kiddush Hashem of my life, and there are rare occasions I may have, when I was able to be an ambassador of my faith to the world and show them that Judaism is life-affirming and luminescent. And the greatest pain I've had in my life is when I've made a Chilul Hashem. When I've argued with a woman in the airport from one of the airlines who wouldn't let me on because it was too late. And I'm sitting there with a yarmulke and I'm yelling at her and everybody's looking. The greatest joy I've had was when my life was a Kiddush Hashem. There's nothing like it. To be a Jew in the modern world and to bring pride to your faith. And the greatest pain is when I have disgraced my faith. It's when I've been called myself Orthodox, but I've behaved as if I have no values. I have no straitjacket on my emotions. Don't go through the motions in a school. I did that and I hated it. That's why I couldn't stand the Friday morning assemblies. It was a confirmation to me of everything that was wrong with my education. It was just rote. It was a routine. It was just someone speaking to me that didn't get me, that didn't understand me, and I didn't feel that there was any connection. You guys can create that connection. Make your Judaism personal. Bring it into your heart. Make it something you live by. Make it reflect in your actions. Go home this Shabbos and be different. Go to your parents and offer to help for Shabbos much more than you did the week before. If you have younger siblings, help with them. If you see a mess, clean it up. If you have something bad to say about someone, start practicing not saying it. If you watch too much Access Hollywood or any of these other dumb celebrity, start being arrogant. Start focusing more on yourself than them. There's no such thing as healing the world without making it something concrete, rooted deeply in positive action. The greatest Jewish contribution to the world is called a mitzvah. To do that one good deed, the power of a single good deed. Thank you very much.